Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Steve White. In his 43rd year of a canine-centered law enforcement career, Steve White is the only person to have served as a handler, trainer, training sergeant, and supervisor for the Seattle Police Canine Unit. Accredited as a master trainer in 1993 by the Washington State Police Canine Association, Steve is also a past executive board member of that body. He served as vice president of the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers and is a consultant and instructor for the Canine Academy for Law Enforcement. Steve has instructed at seminars in the US, Australia, Belgium, Canada, China, Finland, Japan, Mexico, here in New Zealand, Spain, and the United Kingdom. He has served as a primary instructor for Karen Pryor's Clicker Expo and the Karen Pryor Academy for Animal Training and Behaviour. His articles have appeared in police, canine, and dog training publications in the US, Canada, Australia, Finland, and Japan. He specializes in teaching behavior modification, tracking, and scent work through the use of positive reinforcement-based operant conditioning. He provides consultation and training to canine units on administrative and legal issues and has been recognized as an expert witness by Washington and federal courts in police, canine, and dog behavior matters. So, without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one, Steve White, to the show today, who's patiently waiting by. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing well, Ryan. How are you doing today?
Doing fantastic. And it's an absolute honor to have you on the show, Steve. I sit here and marvel at 43 years of doing this.
That's, well, just everybody does what they do. And I just happen to get lucky and get started at a young age and have been enjoying it ever since. I haven't seen any reason to stop. Even when I wasn't assigned to a canine unit, I always had my dog and canine related stuff going on the side. So,
well, I'm going to just say it now. 90 minutes is not going to do 43 years of justice today, but we're going to try to unpack as much value as we can in the coming episode. So let's dive straight in, Steve, to the first question. Can you please take everyone listening back to 43 years ago, where you first got started, and what part of your journey you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training, and share some stories from that time?
Well, it actually goes even farther back than 43 years. 43 years is when my law enforcement canine career started. But back when I was a kid in New York, I moved there when I was 10 years old, son of a single mother. And we had a small dog. And I'd take him for a walk from our apartment down to the park and see other people walking their dogs. When they went away on vacation or I had something going, they asked me if I'd walk their dogs for them. So while other kids were making money babysitting and doing other things, I was making money walking dogs from the beginning. And I found that life was a lot easier for myself if, you know, I had some treats in my hand or I had toys the dogs like. And that's what kind of got me started. Then when I went into, as an adult later on, I went into formal obedience training, looking to get into the dog business. I took obedience classes, and those classes were all force-based. Leash and choke chain from the very beginning, Everything was about corrections and the negative reinforcement-based approach. And that continued in my first class when I went in the Army. And the first dog I had, his name was Astro. Astro was, I don't know how to describe him. He was a little coyote-looking thing. I mean, they're all these beautiful German shepherds. They lined us all up at the end of our first week. The first week, you never even touch a dog. You just learn about how to clean dog food pans, how to clean the kennels, and they teach you how to praise a rock, and you would sit there and praise a rock. Or they give you an ammo can full of rocks, and you'd praise that. And then you'd hook your leash to that, and you'd learn to make leash corrections to that ammo can full of rocks. And then they'd hook your leash to a fence, and you learn how to make corrections that way. Learn how to scream, no! And they pray. And when they taught you to praise your ammo can or your rock, it was, atta good boy, atta good dog, atta good baby. I mean, you'd... And that it was just rote. Everybody was saying the same thing because, when you're in a military context, it's about churning people through a system as quickly as you can, getting them in the field because you don't have them for very long in training and they're not going to be on the job very long after that. 2 to 4 years, maybe if you're lucky. So it's a lowest common denominator approach. So everybody is taught the same thing and there are certain compromises that come with that. But apparently Astro didn't understand that. Because on the day that we marched into the squad, into the kennel, for the first time to get our dogs, I was in the middle of the pack. There were people in front of me, people behind me, and they just ordered us. We say, forward march. And then first person you stop at the last kennel. The second person you stop at the second to last kennel. Well, when we were all lined up at a kennel, we all stopped. And then they said, left face, meet your dog. And there I am looking at this little orange. We didn't have Malinois back then, but he was Malinois size, but he was all orange colored. And he looked at me and cocked his head. And I looked at him and cocked my head. We didn't know what to make of each other. But then they said, go in and meet your dog. So I enter the kennel and immediately he starts moving away from me. Goes to the opposite corner of the run. I didn't know any better. I didn't know what's going on. So I just let him do that. And he's just circling around. Just moving in circles around that. So finally I say, that's it. So I go sit on the edge of the doghouse because the doghouses were built onto the kennel and they were about an 18-inch step to jump up into the house. So I could sit on that thing. And he just keeps circling around in front of me, slow pacing movement, always keeping his eye on me. I didn't know what was going on. I just figured, I was clueless, completely clueless, didn't know what to think. And at one point, Astro came up to me and stopped by my leg. And then he put his head on my leg as it was sitting there. And I thought, oh, that's nice. He wants to be friends. I go to pet him. Immediately his head comes up and he starts circling again. Now, this is 1975. So I didn't get the significance of the music. But every time he started circling, you could hear this dun, 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 like the theme music to Jaws. I didn't know what was going on, but he was building up tension. Second time he came back around, he put his head on my, I said, okay, I'm not going to pet him yet. And then he put his paw next to his head on my leg. And I thought, oh, he really does want to be friendly. I started to pet him. Oh, off he goes, starts circling again. And finally, about the third or fourth time he comes back, he puts both paws on my leg. He comes up and he puts his head right next to mine. And I'm sitting there with him and I'm going, oh, what a nice dog. And I start to stroke his shoulder with my left hand. I can remember it to this day, with my left hand on his right shoulder. And as I start to touch him there, he just goes, this deep growl. I didn't know what I was doing. I was scared to death. My hands had a life of their own. And all of a sudden, my right hand came to meet my left hand. And I pushed him on the chest, launched him across that thing, and got up and get away and started heading for the gate. And I got there just before his jaws snapped on that. And that's what started our relationship. And it was a rocky relationship. And later on the week that we were starting to teach the dogs down, Astro had never been made to down. The background they had on him is they found him in somebody's backyard in the Midwest somewhere on a buying trip, and they brought him back. He knew nothing. And the way they taught our dogs to down was hardcore force. And long story short, the story is not pretty, and it's part of what got me where I am today. But that was the moment when Astro bit me while we were trying to teach him down, trying to force him to lie down, that I said, there has got to be a better way. He bit me so badly that it put me back a couple of weeks, and I wound up starting another class with a different dog. That dog went to another handler. He bit that handler. They said, okay, maybe he's not a patrol dog, because patrol dogs had to be able to be taught out. So they made him a sentry dog, where they don't teach the dogs out. They just teach them to bite, and then they physically remove them from the bite. He wound up biting that handler, too. Still, they certified him and sent him off to Morocco with that Marine. I never know what happened to him after that. But I owe my change in philosophy about that, because my obedience instructors and my army instructors had told me that, you know, you can make a dog work or you can make a dog want to work. If you can't make them want to work, then you make them work. And I came to realize that that's not so much so. You can only, you don't have that degree of control over an animal. You can create consequences and set them up for success, and you can create consequences that are aversive that may challenge that. But if you do that, you are setting the stage for a war with your animal if you're not careful. And that's what happened with him. It wasn't an overnight change. I still stuck with my army methods, but even when I got to my first duty station, I started experimenting with the use of toys and the use of food, because the army had already been using food for training some of its bomb dogs. And so I wasn't completely out of pocket when I did that. But to this day, I think back on that as the moment where I said, there's got to be a better way. And I'm grateful. I'm really grateful for Astro because although that was a lot of pain, and I got to tell you, man, it was a lot of pain. It was worth it because I think my life with a lot of other animals has gotten a lot easier as a result of that. He taught me a big lesson.
And it's interesting that kind of reflect back on that pivotal moment. I say it's interesting because other guests have shared pivotal moments like that exact moment when they, for example, Peggy Hogan in a recent episode said when she did something, she looked at the kids and she could see it in their eyes. Can you remember you were training with Astro and you said he bit you? Was it kind of a gradual process for you where you were just mulling this stuff over, or was there a specific moment?
Well, no. At the moment, you see, because he tried to bite me three times before this in the process of teaching him down. And each time I did what my instructors told me, which is apply more force. Every time he does this, he's challenging you. You don't let him challenge you. You're going to win him. So I did what my instructors told me to. And so this is one of the things that it also changed the way I talk about dealing with people. My instructor said, well, okay, hang him. So I did. Okay, second time, hang him and spin. Third time, airplane him, which means you spin a little faster and his feet actually come off the ground. I am not proud of that, but that is what didn't know any better, and that's what they told me to do, and that's what's going on. And each one of those, as I did it, I thought I was doing the right thing. So finally, that fourth time where I said, I don't care. I don't care how slippery this chain is that slided through my hands. If he tries to bite me, I don't care. I'm going to keep it down, and this hand is not moving. I'm going to keep it down. Well, he thrashed around enough that chain slid through my hands. It was a hot Texas day. We had just oiled our leashes with fresh neat's foot oil. My hand was slippery, and that thing slid through there. He got a hold of my hand, and that hurt. That wasn't the moment, because at the moment that happened, just as it had been before, my Air Force instructors, I was in the Army at the time, my instructors were Air Force, and they were calling me all kinds of Army names. They, you know, I was a pansy, I was a wussy, I was this or that. And then one of them said, oh, look at the blood. And there was just this big old spurt of blood coming out of my hand from that. And that wasn't the moment. The moment that there had to be a better way was when I was walking back to the kennels with him to go get my hand looked back. So I had him walking him with one hand and he wasn't fighting me. We were just walking along like any other people taking a walk. And I realized as I'm walking with this dog, and I said, look, he's not like this all the time. And I started, for me, that was the contrast at that point. And I realized, look, I was just doing what they told me. And that was the moment when I said, yeah, these people know more than I do about a lot of things. But in one case, in this particular, they're just doing what somebody told them. And I was a little, you know, there was a moment when I was a little torqued off at them because they put me in a position to get bit by this dog. But again, they're just doing what they had been taught and had worked well enough for them to, they've been reinforced for doing it by their peers, by their superiors, and by enough of the dogs with which they worked that was, you know, that was the go-to technique in their repertoire. And Astro really just taught me there. I said, wow, this dog isn't a problem until you try and force him. And then when you force him, he says, there's only so much I'm going to take. And then I'm going to try and force you to leave me alone. You see people like that. You see dogs like that. And you realize that there's something in their background, maybe something in their genes, but I think it's just as likely there's something in their background that where they say, okay, that's the limit. And that's all I'm going to take. You don't have to get to that point with your animal. A lot of people say you need to get to that point and then show them who's boss. And I've found that actually all that happens with that is then they find other ways to work around it. You know, if you're using negative reinforcement as your primary training technique, the one drawback you have is for most animals, especially the way most people apply the techniques, the animal only work as hard as it takes to make you turn off the annoyance. And then once that's done, pressure's off. They don't feel the need to work so hard anymore. You really do have to find something they're willing to work for rather than something they're willing to work to avoid. And I began to realize at that moment, it wasn't that moment, but over time I began to realize that those instructors, and I would say it was actually, it probably took me 20 years after that. In fact, I can tell you exactly the moment when I began to have empathy for those instructors. I was at a police canine seminar with Professor Steve McKenzie, who is a North American Police Work Dog Associated Master Trainer. He's a reserve deputy with the Schoharie County Sheriff's Office in New York State. But what he really is on his day job, he's a PhD animal behaviorist for the State University of New York in Cobleskill. This is a smart dude. We all call him Doc. Dr. McKenzie is brilliant. And we were watching a problem-solving session at a police canine seminar, which the problem-solving session usually means my dog won't out, won't let go of the bad guy when we tell him to. And we're watching a trainer go through his bag of tricks trying to get a particular dog to out. And I'm standing there, and I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but I'm smart enough when around a PhD who's been around longer than I have to shut my mouth and listen to him. And I listened as he started anticipating what this guy was going to do next. That didn't work, so he's going to up the ante here. That didn't work, so he's going to do that. So here, and he was nailing it. Time after time, he predicted what this guy was going to do. And I was amazed. And at one point, I was like, oh, man, this is going over the top. And, you know, the guy went off on a tangent in a different direction than Steve predicted on one time. Finally, at one point, he went a different way. And Steve said, I wonder why he did that. And then he said, well, it must have worked for him at some point. We are all the product of our reinforcement. And he said, that guy's no different. And our reinforcement history, our punishment histories bring us to where we are today. And I started realizing at the moment I was watching this guy that I was about to judge, because you know what they say about dog trainers, right? Particularly canine trainers is even worse. There's only one thing that two dog trainers can agree on, and that is that the third one's doing something wrong. They can't even agree on what it is he's doing wrong. They're just going to agree that the third trainer is doing something wrong. And I was about ready to fall prey to that paradigm with McKenzie, but luckily I was just in awe of his flow, and so I just shut my mouth and listened to it. And as I was about ready to do that, he came up with that statement about it must have worked for him in the past. And I realized a lot of us happen that we'll get that one trial learning, and that will become our go-to thing. If in that moment of particular stress or frustration, something happens to work, maybe it's just a superstitious belief. Maybe some other aspect of this created the result. But if we attribute the change to what we did, we will go back and we'll do that over and over again. And that's what happened with those instructors that told me to force Astro to down. It had worked for him enough in the past that it was worth it. Maybe even on a random schedule. So it was really resistant to extinction. But that moment with McKenzie is when all of a sudden I started having more empathy for the loop end of the leash.
So I think this is so exciting because we're in 2018 now, obviously. Mm-hmm. We're going back to that story with Astro to 1975, did you say?
Yeah, Astro was 75. And the conversation with Steve McKenzie, if I remember correctly, was 1996, 21 years later. And here we are 22 years after that.
And so I'm thinking of people in 2018 in situations where they can see that there is a better way. They might have observation skills like you had back then where you could see that Astro was not like this being bitey or whatever we want to, behaviors we want to talk about. He was not like this all the time. Now, I can only imagine, especially that period of time ago, I have no education or knowledge or experience in the army, but I've seen the Hollywood depictions of it, and I can appreciate that you said there you were being called pansy and wussy and all this kind of stuff. It must have been a challenging kind of situation to think clearly through because you've got all of these. Am I correct here, or were you able to kind of control your emotions?
Well, yes and no. If there's one thing the military teaches you, it's you need to do what is expected of you at the time to do it because other people's lives depend on it. Everybody depends on everybody else doing their thing at one point. And if somebody doesn't fulfill their role, then somebody else may be put at jeopardy. So you learn, do what you're told, when you're told, the way you're told, until you're told not to do it anymore. So in that regard, you don't have time to think about it. You're just doing it. So you learn to compartmentalize your emotions. That's why in the moment I was doing that stuff with Astro, I don't think, other than the fear of getting bit those first few times and the resolve to put up with it, that was me being, I'm going to do my job and the way I'm told, whatever the cost. Because remember, when you're in the Army, you are susceptible to being a professional bullet stopper. You know, it's not, you know, that's not the object. You want to make the other side be the professional bullet stoppers, but you are susceptible to wind up getting killed yourself. And so getting bit by a dog is small potatoes compared to that. And so the Army and the military in general teaches you to compartmentalize your emotions to get through the moment, get through the mission. And then afterwards, a lot of people don't have a process to you know, or don't have a, they don't create their own process for processing the emotions that happen in it. And that's why you see, you know, alcoholism rates, PTSD, and a variety of other things that afflict the human component on this. And I was lucky. I don't think it was anything special about me. I just happened to think that on that walk back with that dog, I was just struck by how different he was from just moments earlier. What a huge difference there was between this dog that was, you know, thrashing my hand and this dog that's now walking alongside of me as if like, hey, everything's cool. And that's when I started to process this for myself. You know, the anger at the instructors came up at me, the anger at myself for failing, you know, that stuff that we all tend to do to ourselves was there. But the resolve also to get better at this, because I really liked working with animals. I knew that was what I wanted to do. And I think that in that moment, or in those moments walking back, I probably did more reflection about what, you know, where I was going to go, how I was going to get there, making decisions what I wanted to do. Some of those decisions didn't help me because I bought into the, okay, the mission comes first, you compartmentalize. I did all of that stuff that comes with that. And, you know, it took many years after that for me to start to really understand where we're going. I think I've kind of gone afield from your question. I'm not sure whether I have or haven't, but...
Well, I'm thinking, you know, as you're telling that story, before we got up to the to point about Doc, can I call him Doc?
Yeah, Doc McKenzie.
Yeah, Doc McKenzie. Before you got up to that point, I was thinking, I'm going to ask Steve, like, how did he... What was his process to deal with the processing of emotions that he had compassion for people at that time? But you were saying that it kind of took you a significant chunk of time to get that compassion, and it came from that experience with Doc McKenzie. So I'm just thinking about people in 2018. Now, there's going to be a lot of people who listen to this podcast that aren't in the military, obviously, right? But right. They might find themselves in a similar situation in society where...
Mm-hmm. We're there, you know, all the time.
Exactly. So let's frame this question this way then, Steve. If the Steve White from that session with Doc McKenzie could go back in time and talk to the Steve White in 1975, working with Astro as you're walking back with Astro, nice and calmly on the leash after being bitten, what would that Steve White say to the earlier Steve White?
Every one of us, human, dog, whatever, we are where we are. How we got there is an important backstory in many ways, but in any moment, you can make the decision to change. You can make that decision to change. And judgment and self-judgment aren't going to do you any good. Self-reflection, self-examination, self-critical analysis is good, because only by getting a true assessment of yourself can you actually love yourself. And if you can't love yourself, you're not going to love anybody else. And a lot of people love animals. Look, in the grand scheme of thing in this world, giant Venn diagram. Okay, people listening, imagine a big circle. That's the whole world. That's population. In that circle, there's another little circle. It's not a big circle, but it's a pretty, it's a circle we're all familiar with. In that circle, you put the letters DP. Those are dog people. We're the ones who have shirts that say, I heart name the breed, right? We're the ones that have bumper stickers on our car that say, dog is my co-pilot. We're the ones that, you know, believe me, I don't have to go any farther to perpetuate the stereotype. Those are dog people. Maybe some of us are dog people. Not all of us, but some of us, I'm going to say, we're dog people because we're not so much people. You know, and then there are these other people over here, another little circle out of the big one. Those are CP, control people. These are the people that Oprah and Dr. Phil would say have control issues. Where those two circles overlap, those are the dog trainers. Those are the people who really just like gravitate. I'm not saying all of them, not all of us, but I'm going to say I have a triple whammy on top of that because I got the PP, and that's the police people, Popo. And where that overlaps, you get canine trainers. So we have dog people control issues and police control issues all rolled into one. It is a huge thing. And I would go back and I would tell that 19-year-old Steve White, the everything you think you can control is an illusion. The only thing you can control is how you respond to what life throws in front of you. And the beauty of dogs is that's all they do. They just respond to what life throws in front of them. They, you know, they'll control things. They'll try and control resources and protect things and that. But that's because they perceive threat to something that they think is valuable. And people are the same way. We're not as different as we think we are. And it's a lot easier to take a breath and give somebody a break for a moment and figure out, okay, where are they coming from in this moment? Not where, what brought them here 20 years ago, 5 years ago, 5 weeks ago. It's like dog training is like MapQuest or Google Maps. When you want to find some place, you only need two pieces of information and where you are and where you want to be. And Google Maps, if you've got it on your phone, it tells you where you are right now. So it's accurate with that. It knows. It doesn't need to know where you were 2 weeks ago. Doesn't need to know where you were 5 years ago. Doesn't need to know if you were potty trained roughly as a child. It doesn't need to know whether you're in touch with your inner child or not. It just needs to know where are you and where you want to go. And that's one of the beauties of a behaviorist approach to training is it takes the animal for where it is right then and there without having to invest itself in how it got there. And that can save you a lot of troubles. I take history on every client I have. And for me, that's useful. But the thing that so many trainers don't do, they just wait in and start training instead of taking a baseline. See where this animal is first, right there in that moment, and then make your training decisions instead of trying to train something that you haven't really assessed before that. And you know, you do that same thing with people. And with people, it's easier than it is with animals. Animals, you got to set up some kind of a scenario. With a person, we can sit and talk and have a conversation. And unfortunately, that ease of having a conversation is also what gets in the way of our giving people the benefit of the doubt. Because we think because we said something, they understood it the same way, that that they're on board to the same extent that we are. And this is where we don't give each other a fair break. So, and we're going to talk some more about that at some point, too. I think we can dive into that piece of it in greater depth, too.
Let's potentially take this opportunity because this is where we are. And dive into this and just wanted to potentially rewind and pull out some of the tidbits that I've taken away from your story and inject them in here and see how they help us move forward in this conversation. But you said two dog trainers will always say the third one is doing something wrong. They'll find something. Everything you think you control is an illusion. The only thing you can control is what life throws in front of you. And you talked a lot about compassion. And so you, this is what we're going to talk about in the bulk of this episode. You and I discussed this earlier. So let's dive into this now. What does this look like? What does giving people compassion look like? You said sit down and have a conversation. But if we're a dog trainer, 2018, we're surrounded by a group of peers that are doing stuff differently than we know. Mm-hmm. And we know about positive reinforcement. We can see that our dogs are responding to this. How do we have compassion in that moment? What does that look like?
People behave in a manner consistent with the way the situation appears to them. I'm going to repeat that. People will behave consistent in a manner with the way the situation appears to them. Their behavior may be different from yours because they see the situation differently. They perceive it differently than you do. So rather than judging them for their behavior at that moment, judging them person because they gave that dog a leash pop, I think the appropriate response rather than condemnation is curiosity. First and foremost, before anything, get curious. I've had to learn this in my own relationships. Look, like I said, I'm a dog person because I'm not so much a people person. I get that. And you can probably ask my first wife. She might tell you that. And my second one might also. I love, you know, Jen and I are lucky we met through animal training. But I'm going to say that this is something that applies on your intimate relationships, your business relationships, your casual contacts, and our relationships with animals, that when something doesn't go as expected, our first response, I think the one that serves us best in the long run, maybe not in the moment, but the one that serves us best in the long run is curiosity. And by being curious about why that happened, why someone would do something. That's what Steve McKenzie did. That moment where Steve McKenzie did what I told you, where when this trainer did something he didn't expect, he didn't judge it. He just said, I wonder why he did that. Well, it must have worked for him at some point. And Steve went on and had a conversation with him about it to find out more because his curiosity was sparked and it wasn't satisfied. So he had to go satisfy his curiosity and get more information. And I think that's one of the things that Steve, to this day, I mean, I haven't seen Steve McKenzie in close to 20 years. Only talked with him once since then, but I will never forget the guy. And I will never never stop including him as one of my friends, because he's a class guy who does amazing things with animals, who had a profound impact on me at a time when I needed it. And I think that when it comes to people, if I can model some of that, rather than, you know, when a client comes in or a police canine handler comes in, or good example, you could be working with a group of trainers, and let's say a dog shows a tendency to balk at something, doesn't want to jump off of something or up onto something, or doesn't want to go into a slick floor. There are some canine trainers, because that's kind of been in the culture for a long time, who will say, oh, just give him a little nudge, you know, or run with him to the edge and then just give him a little push and then he'll get over it. And they do that. And then what happens is they see that next time they give the dog the opportunity to do it, the dog's resistance is actually higher than it was before. Sometimes some dogs do get over it and they're fine, but some dogs don't. And so we had a conversation about just this sort of a thing. And this weekend at this canine seminar I was at, and one of the things we came to the conclusion is we all agreed, if the dog can make the right choice for itself, it's more likely to make it again. But if you take its choice away, it's more likely to resist. Does that sound like Astro to you? Sounds like Astro to me. And some dogs aren't going to resist by trying to fight you. They're just going to resist by trying to get away from the situation. Or some are just going to resist by, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to just collapse right here and shut down. People are the same way. They come to dog trainers. You know, our audience is largely going to be civilians. I'm not talking to my military trainers. I'm not talking to my police trainers here in large part. I hope some of them are listening. But our audience is mostly going to be people that are in the civilian range training a variety of animals besides dogs. I'm a dog guy, but I work with other species. And the one thing I can tell you is animals and people are the same way this way. People come into a dog trainer's studio. Most of the time when they come into your business saying, I want you to train my dog, they don't come in saying, I'm here because I just want the best relationship ever with my dog. They come in because if this dog doesn't stop doing this, I'm going to take it to the pound. And we know what's going to happen if it goes to the pound. The number one cause of euthanasia in the United States for dogs are behavior problems. Not any kind of disease, not any kind of injury, behavior problems. More dogs are killed in this country for that reason than for anything to do with health. And it really makes me sad, because every one of those is preventable. And but the reality is, people are at their wits' ends. They don't know what to do. And they just do what gives them momentary relief. And if you think about it, punishment by its definition reinforces the punisher. Because if the dog is barking, digging, scratching, and you throw something at it and it stops, or you give it a leash correction and it stops, or you yell at it and it stops, for that brief moment that it stops, you get relief. And then the animal does it again, you yell and it stops, you get relief. Now you're starting to develop a reinforcement history for the use of punishment. It negatively reinforces you. It takes away the annoying thing. And then next thing you know, you're in a cycle with your animal. And then there's some animals that never figure out that, oh, I just shouldn't do that at all. Sometimes they're just so glad for your attention. If it's not the kind of attention they want, they'll take the attention they can get. And we've seen that with our own teenage kids. So when a person comes in and they start to correct their dog for me, I've watched other trainers immediately say, just jump on that person, say, don't do that. We don't do that here. You can't do that here. And I've seen others say, oh, what's going on with you? Ask the question, what's going on right now? Well, he's doing this, or he's trying to, you know, he's trying to dominate me. He's trying to this or that, whatever. The dog is trying to control the circumstances. And some people are afraid to let go of that control at that moment. And actually, I've watched some good trainers that have skill with the dog just completely fall apart when it comes to teaching the other side of the leash and helping those people get past their need for that momentary relief. Even if it's just relief from embarrassment. I mean, if you're walking down the street and your dog greets somebody and it jumps up, you have this embarrassment and you pull a dog back. You don't want the dog getting somebody else's clothes dirty. You've got concerns about that. Those things are all there. In that moment, that's there. And it makes you more likely when you see that next person approaching your dog to get worried and anxious about what's going to happen. And that starts setting you in the mindset to start making those corrections. And is it the most effective way? Can we teach other ways? Can we, you know, can we counter cue that dog? Can we teach incompatible behaviors? Yes, we can, but not if that person hasn't got that in their repertoire yet. And I think we think just telling a person, all you need to do is this, is enough. And they should, and then now you're in a position, I've told you this, I can judge you if you don't do it. No, if we shape animals' behavior through successive approximation, we need to shape people's behavior through successive approximations and give them those little baby steps that get them along the way to being self-sufficient. My job when I train somebody is to make them not need me anymore. I want to work myself out of business, at least with that person, whether it's a canine handler, whether it's a detector dog handler, whether it's a civilian client, doesn't matter to me. My goal is to make that person self-sufficient, because I don't believe, like in my professional culture, we have master trainers and handlers. Do you think the dog makes that distinction? No. Dogs don't care. They don't care what title you have or anything like that. You're either, in the dog's mind, I mean, people can say this is anthropomorphic. I get it. But for all intents and purposes, life with an animal is a series of feedback loops between the two of you. And so you're either the trainer or you're the trainee. And dogs have it way easier than we do. All they have to do is say, how do I make this hairless primate say good and give me stuff? Whereas if you're a human being, you not only have to worry about what's going on with this dog, you have to think about, who's this person coming down the street? Is the light red? Did I turn the iron off? Did I lock the front door? Will there be peace in the Middle East? Who's going to be the next president of the United States? All of these things intrude on our presence with our animal. And then when we aren't present with them, they go, well, if you're not connected to me, I'm not connected to you. I'm going to entertain myself. And off they go sniff a bush while you're trying to walk. Or they're going to be interested in that other dog going the other way. Because you haven't made yourself more interesting than spit on the sidewalk for them. So I think when we work with our dogs like this, it's really important for us to put our judgment aside. And when we as trainers work with other people, it's really important to put judgment aside and give people the benefit of the doubt and help them take the baby steps and realize they're not going to hear it the first time. They're not going to hear it the second time, the third, the fourth, the fifth. Maybe if you're lucky, about the seventh time you say something, it will start to stick and they'll really start to inculcate it into their repertoire. Giving people a little bit of break and not judging somebody because they use a different technique. I've seen dogs that are amazingly happy with people who that other trainers would say are using methods that are cruel. And then I've seen dogs that are confused and anxious in the hands of trainers who are fully committed to using nothing but non-aversive methods. It's not the choice of method isn't as reliable a predictor of the outcome for the dog as a lot of people think it is. And I think that's one of the things that, now I say this as somebody who's committed to using positive reinforcement methods as much as I possibly can and trying to convert, I wouldn't say convert, but to put positive reinforcement based tools into the hands of people who have traditionally used force to get things done to see if maybe that gives them better outcomes. I'm not going to try and control their outcomes, but I'm going to give them the opportunity. This is like a plate of cookies. I'm going to offer it. I don't say, here, let me shove this cookie down your throat.
And so I guess, and for those listening, and I think, you know, I'm reflecting on social media in 2018, and suddenly we've actually removed the fact that we're in front of a person in real time and we've got this like internet and keyboard in front of us. I think potentially people forget this even more. That's just my own musings. So we've got to shape ourselves seemingly. And for the people listening that might reflect on some of their experiences throughout their career as part of that little circle and that bigger circle of humanity of DPs, where they've didn't have, as you mentioned before, potentially the processes to process the emotions mm-hmm. in the moment. How can you offer some input to people? How can we take everything you've just said and in the moment, as the blood leaves our brain and goes to our muscles, getting ready to fight or run away, how can we create curiosity? What can bring us back to that state that Doc McKenzie was in that made him go,
I don't know how Doc got there. I know he did it through years of academic training, but I can tell you, I'm going to be honest. My wife and I have been to couples counseling. And the approach we take is the counselor that we're going to uses an approach in which they foster curiosity. And in the beginning, when we first started, it was we didn't give each other the benefit of the doubt. So that when I got curious, it sounded formulaic, because in the beginning, it actually almost has to be formulaic. You have to repeat the behavior enough until it actually becomes natural. Are you familiar? Have you ever heard of a fellow by the name of Patrick Lencioni?
I have not.
He's a business writer. He has a series of books on this. He calls them management fables. And he talks about you know, team building and growth and functionality. And, you know, I think one of the things that strikes me is he knows that when you make a change, there is going to be a dip in performance. You ask anybody that's been going along doing something for a long period of time, and then they make a change in what they do to a superior procedure. You know, you've been doing a protocol for, you know, you're in the zoological community. So let's say you're trying to get an animal to station at a target, and you've been doing something for a long time. You've got a way to do it. It works this way. Somebody has developed another procedure. They showed that they've been able to get results for a while. You adopt it. But because you've been doing something for so long, you're on autopilot, your hands are functioning automatically, your timing is fast, all that stuff. When you institute a new thing, you have to think about it more. So all of a sudden now, things go a little slowly. There's usually when you implement change, there's a downturn, a brief downturn in performance. And unfortunately, most people, that's when they decide, oh, this isn't working, I'm not going to do it anymore. They don't give themselves enough repetitions to get past the downturn to the point where they equal their old performance and actually get to a new baseline that is up higher than the previous performance was before. So when my wife and I had to go through couples counseling, you know, we had to get through that trough, that downturn, as we did things that were new to us. So the recommendation I would give for anybody, whether it's in couples counseling, whether it's dog training, whatever, do new stuff when you don't have a deep investment in it. Don't try to do it in the heat of the moment. Get curious when there's not big stakes. Get the mechanics of this process when you can relax and be more at ease, so that when the stakes are higher, you got a better chance of actually having the, you know, the their neuromuscular pathways and the thought pathways you need to implement this. And it's going to take time. You're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes. But take every one of those mistakes as another opportunity to get curious. Failure is just information. Everybody gets wrapped around the axle about it, particularly in the training context. You know, when something doesn't work as you expect, rather than getting mad about it, you should look at this as an opportunity. I view training as a get to, not a got to. I get to train this. I get to go take this to the next level instead of, oh, I got to fix this. You know, because everything we think is a problem, you know, we say, oh, my dog jumps up, or my dog barks, or my dog does this or that. We see those things as problems. Those are not the problems. Those are the symptoms. That if you treat the underlying behavioral deficit and you build a skill, the symptom goes away. So dogs that jump up, that's not the problem. If you build the skill of polite greeting, four on the floor greetings, or sitting for greetings, then the problem itself goes away. And you don't have to do it by focusing on the problem. If you focus on the problem by trying to hammer the problem, all you're going to do is create more tension in that dog and conflict and confusion and more stress for yourself. By working on building the skill deficit that the symptom reveals, you save yourself a lot of trouble. And that's where the curiosity comes in. So in that moment when you're frustrated because your dog jumps up, you ask yourself, the curiosity question is, what would the behavior I want look like? And if you could say, and it's not a negative, it's not, well, not jumping up. Get more specific. What would it look like? Oh, we'd stand calmly on all 4 feet and let the person pet him. Okay, so now we have a description of the behavior we want. Now we can work towards shaping that behavior. Instead of trying to hammer the problem of jumping up, we can work on that. And it's not, you know, that's the simplest of examples, but it goes all the way through complex search chains, high-risk tactical dog work, you know, with SWAT teams and with military teams. No, you know, getting a clear picture of what you want rather than focusing on this thing that you think is the problem helps you get your results a lot faster, saves you a lot of stress, and it's a good exercise for you for everything, where you can start trying to get a hold of your own thoughts and emotions and ask those questions in the moment. You know, there's more than one person in my life that told me that it's really important to be to take almost this Buddhist mindset of being a disinterested observer of self. So rather than having an investment in the outcome of a moment like this, all of a sudden, step back from yourself. When you feel yourself getting triggered, feeling reactive about what your dog doing or what that trainer is doing across the room from you or on the other side of the internet from you, take a moment and ask yourself, wow, why is this hitting me this way? Do what it takes to get yourself safe and start asking those questions and then see how you want to proceed from there. But the first thing to do is to look at like, wow, why am I reacting this way? Not why are they doing that? Why is the dog doing that? Why is he doing that? Why am I reacting this way? Now, how can I go ahead and move forward from here without letting the reaction on this? How can I respond rather than react?
So in the words of Simon Sinek, I don't know if you're familiar with him, start with why. I've got a book here I can show you.
I love it.
Start with why. So great. And another thing that you and I talked about when we caught up earlier this week or late last week, I can't remember exactly when it was this idea of not only communicating with other trainers with compassion, curiosity, but also with our sister sciences. And you said to me that you're something that piqued your interest in the email I sent you to inquire as to whether you would be generous enough of your time and become a guest on the Animal Training Academy podcast show was you like this idea of the show talking about all of the different lenses that we can use to look at behavior. Can you talk about your input, your offerings on the importance of needing to communicate between our scientific communities and ecology, neuroscience, applied behavior analysis, all these lenses we have to look at behavior?
I say this as somebody who is a proud user of marker training and positive reinforcement based methods. I think you could qualify me as a small B behaviorist that I use behaviorist approach to do my training. But at the same time, I think ethologists have something really valuable to tell us. I believe that every animal brought in front of us, whether that is, an amoeba all the way up to, an orca whale or the hairless, nearly hairless primates that we are, is a product of its genetics and its environment. And to deny the genetic component, I think, can put us at a disadvantage sometimes when understanding an animal and giving an opportunity. Yes, we can have preconceived notions that are completely wrong. But I mean, think about it from a logical perspective. I'm just going to talk about dogs because dogs are a synthetic construct. Some wild canid somehow got in the hands of human beings. And now we've created everything from Irish wolfhounds down to Chihuahuas. They've all served some purpose along the way that someone said, this is more like what I need or more like what I want. And I'm going to breed these dogs, try and get even closer to what I need or want with it. And they make it suitable for work. And for a long time, a lot of dogs, strictly, there really wasn't any such thing as a pet dog, or there were very few people could afford to have a pet dog. Only people of exceptional wealth. Most of the dog breeds we're familiar with were created for a work purpose, a functional purpose. They hunted, they herded, they protected. Some were companions. But for the most part, they had some way to earn their keep. And those that were better at than others were the ones that stayed in the gene pool by our artificial selection. So by definition, we are selecting for inheritable traits. So to ignore those inheritable traits when we're training, I think, does us a disservice. And we're not the only ones that select this, because natural selection, by definition, selects for traits. Those that, it doesn't pick, but the ones that are more likely to get reproduce are the ones that are more successful. And it seems silly to me to think that those traits are limited to, physiological traits like the color of coat or the color of feathers or the shape of the bill or the shape of the muzzle, the length of the tail. Behavior is a big part of what makes a species survive and not. Look at two very similar species, chimpanzees and bonobos. You're in the zoological community. Chimpanzees and bonobos have two very different approaches to solving conflict. Yet they share some physiological structural similarities. They share some other behavioral similarities. But the differences in them have somehow served their separate species enough that they became, they did separate. And it worked well for them in their individual environments. When they combine and clash, it's my understanding that, chimpanzee populations will displace bonobo populations in the wild usually. Is that right to your knowledge?
My knowledge of chimpanzee and bonobo wild behavior is limited. I'm unable to answer that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, but they are distinct species and they have different approaches, behavioral approaches, things that are pretty consistent in their population. And I think if we deny that happened naturally and it isn't strictly a product of environment, that this is just happens to be the way they were raised, because you can see it in populations that don't have contact with each other, I think it's probably worth bearing in mind when you're training it. I work with this past weekend, predominantly German Shepherds and Belgian Malinois. Two very different breeds that are designed to do very similar things, both of which are designed as protection breeds. but come from herding stock. They have herding in their name, but they really are less intended for herding purposes and more for protection and working purposes. And yet they have very distinctly different behavioral traits. And you can see it in the way people train with them. They use similar methods, but you have to be on your game in certain ways with the Malinois that you don't with the German Shepherd, and vice versa. So I think it's really important to take what the animal brings to the table based on its genetics. And I think this is where ethologists and people who are knowledgeable about the breeds can do this. You know, Rottweilers are another example of a breed that's different. Here's another working breed that a lot of people don't understand that they get a bad rap. But it's a breed that if you know how to raise it as a puppy, you avoid all the problems that everybody is worried about. They really do take a very clear-headed approach in raising them. But then they grow up and they're awesome dogs. And they, you know, but I'll tell you, Rottweilers love to come and greet you with this growling, rumbling noise. And somebody can be put off by that. But it's just the way they talk. And they're lovely animals, big and powerful. If they decide to fight, they can do a lot of damage. But very different from German Shepherds, very different from Malinois, yet all very capable of doing a very similar job when it comes to protection and police work. And I do think it's worth paying attention to the differences in the breeds when you try to train them. Same thing with horses. Horses are horses, but you know, an Arab or a Dutch warm blood is not the same as a Shire or a Clydesdale. Very, you know, similarities, but you know what? Your Border Collie and your Newfoundland are going to respond to things in very different ways. Yes, they're dogs. Yes, they have some of the same similarities, but you know what? You know, Border Collies will be three behaviors down line before the Newfoundland goes, okay, I'm going to sit now. Just a lot of mass to get moving around. Just the physiology gets in the way of it. So I think, you know, the ethological approach, if we just stuck with it alone, people misinterpret it. You know, a lot of problems come when practitioners get a little bit of knowledge about science, and I'm guilty of this. I'm painting myself with this brush as I say this. We get in trouble when we get a little bit of knowledge about the science of things. And I think that's how the notion that you have to be alpha and pack leader with your dog got started, because, you know, when you look at the work of Lorenz and Tingbergen and those guys like that, talking about the ethological aspects of wild dogs, you know, when Lorenz wrote Man Meets Dog, people kind of grasp onto that, and they tried to build, they took this ethological approach and some speculative stories that were part of it, and they made it the framework for their training approach. Same way with, I mean, people could say the same thing about behaviorism. When you look at the number of pigeons or rats and dogs that B.F. Skinner ever trained, people are training a whole lot of animals based on a very small population of stuff. And some people misunderstand and misapply the science. And I'm guilty. I've done it. I do it. I got to catch myself. I need people to square me away with this. But I think that Karen Pryor once said something that really gets me. She says, it doesn't matter what your approach is. You will be successful to the extent that you comply with the principles. If your method is principle compliant, you're going to be successful. If you start deviating from the principles, it's going to start to get a little wobbly. And I think the same thing can be said about approaches that consider the ethological realities of the animal that you're looking at. So this is where this one of the things that I wish that the animal behavior and the ethology departments, you know, the behaviorists and the ethologists would be in the same building on a college campus and spend time and rub elbows together more, because I think there would be some really cool cross-pollination and deeper understanding of what's going on. And not just on that, I think, you know, when you can have an ethologist come and sit with a behaviorist. I wish, have you ever filled out ethograms?
I have, yep.
Okay. Could you imagine filling out an ethogram about behavior that you're watching like this? Now, sitting with a radical Skinnerian right beside you and someone who's like the, you know, because you're kind of in the middle, you're a positive reinforcement based trainer, but could you imagine having a hardcore Lorenzian and a hardcore Skinnerian side by side with you while you're doing that?
I'd be first very off, curious.
Yeah, sure. They would wonder, A, what are you recording? They would want to record different things. And I'm going to suggest to you that too much of our problems in this community are because we have buts and ors, you know, either ors, rather than both ands. You know what? These approaches should be considered a both and rather than an either or. It doesn't have to be either Skinnerian or Lorenzian. It doesn't have to be either behaviorist or either ethological. Both can apply, and we can borrow from each to get a better understanding of what we're doing with our animals. And that's one of the things I really enjoy about what you're doing. You talk to people who have their feet in both worlds. And I think practitioners who grow up in the business without a lot of science behind it, who actually are really good at it, I've seen some of the most skilled trainers who couldn't tell you how they're doing what they're doing, but they are magical with animals, all right? But if they try and teach somebody how to do it, it comes out of their mouth sounding all just fables and gobbledygook, and it doesn't make sense. And because they're trying to explain in their own head why this works for them, but it does every time, and they get amazing results. And I think that's the thing that that I think both Skinner and Lorenz were trying to do, and Tingberg, they were literally just trying to explain how this happens, not to tell you how to do it. But they're looking for, they were curious about, why does this happen? How does this work? Oh, I think I figured out how this animal comes to do this. I mean, how many people would take the effort to try and figure out how to get geese to follow him when they're newly born, right? How many people would sit on top of a wheat mill in Minnesota and figure out how rats are figuring out how to get food and do things? And both those people to do that had curiosity. And that's what I love. And a lot of really great animal trainers are at their core curious about why the animal does what it does. How much more is it capable of? So much of what is driven by really good trainers is, I wonder what else, you know? And like you, the question you asked, you know, first ask why. And a lot of them start there with those questions. And I think that probably serves us better than gathering knowledge first.
Have you ever read a book called Crucial Conversations, Steve?
No, I haven't.
Because a lot of the stuff you're saying kind of rings so strongly with that. It forms part of our mindset in our members area of my business, Animal Training Academy. And we have a quote that we resonate with at Animal Training Academy, and it is, "The only right I have to express my opinion is to be equally vigorous in encouraging others to share theirs." And I just feel like the stuff you're saying today is a good representation of that.
I think the dog training community and the polarization in it, like if you go on Facebook right now, there are dog training groups that will not talk with each other. Facebook, I think, is this microcosm of society in this way that kind of, in a way, amplifies these things for us to look at and see where these pitched battles are that are vestiges of our human tribal nature. We are a tribal species. There are, you know, I've read of research that says that basically once our affiliative group gets to around 150 as individuals, we can't handle it and we break off and we start creating subgroups. And I think that tribal nature, whether you want to call that hardwiring or not, or product or reinforcement, I don't know. I don't care. It is what it is. And I see it. I mean, look at the political landscape. If you look at this, you've got, you know, for 8 years, you had people who weren't given to one, willing to give one president the benefit of the doubt and give a chance to work. And now you have the other half of the population not willing to give someone the benefit of the doubt and a chance to work. Both will scream bloody foul if you argue the case. And I look at it the same way in the dog training community. I look at it in so many other aspects of what we do, that we would all be better served by really getting curious about why someone believes something so different from what we do. Tell me more about that. Don't try and convince me. Just tell me more about your experience and where we're going. And it's hard to do because it's hard. And, you know, ask my wife, she'll tell you, sometimes she's trying to explain to me her experience and she sees or hears the butt in my voice as I'm busy going, wait a minute, this scares me. Well, those are those moments when you have to stop and you ask, why am I reacting this way? And if you're lucky, you know, you'll catch yourself a week later and realize you did that. Go back and try and make it right. If you get better at what you're doing, maybe an hour later, you start to get a little skill at it. It's in a couple of minutes. And then eventually you're in the moment catching, ooh, that's got me a little aroused. And you can ask for a pause and say, give me a second here. I want to catch something in my, okay, let's go ahead with the conversation. And then eventually you don't even need that. I'm not there yet. Just like I'm not there with training the 100% purely positive police dog. Not there yet. But I want to.
Yeah, it pretty much sounds like you're an author of Crucial Conversations. The stuff you're saying resonates very strongly with the message of that book. Looking at the time, Steve, I think we're going to move towards the end of the episode now. Mm-hmm. I've had so much valuable offerings from you. And I just wanted to say at this point as well, thank you for sharing, and thank you for at one point you said, I'm going to be honest, and you shared with us about marriage counseling and all of that kind of stuff. So thank you for potentially being vulnerable. I don't know if you see it that way, but we appreciate we being myself and the listeners of this podcast, you sharing with us today, lessons from your life, and hopefully helping us as the Animal Training Academy podcast audience move forward, improve our relationships with others and then with the animals, and help animals' lives, obviously. So let's pull everything together in the last 60, 70 minutes. Sum it up in five or 10 minutes. What do you want to see happen now? The next 5 to 10 years, what would you really like to see change? I think we can probably take a good guess after all the things you said, but articulate it for us.
Well, I'll speak to my community first, the police canine community. And that is, I want to see handlers not at war with their dogs. I want to see, and they're not even aware they're at war with their dogs. The classic example, you know, our dogs, a primary job is finding things, because their sense of smell is the one thing we can't replicate, but their ability to be a tool of force is something that's valuable too. And basically a police dog, this is a little secret out here. Police dogs don't have a work ethic. They just think the whole day is nothing but one continuous series of games. Their job every day is to play the best game of hide and seek and tug of war ever. All right. And so they don't know that it's anything but that. So you teach them to control a physical suspect by thinking that it's part of this great tug of war game. I can test whether a handler's relationship with his dog is intact by sending that dog to go seize a quarry, a decoy, a simulated bad guy, a helper, wearing protective sleeve, and have him hold on to it, and then have the handler stand back and watch the dog. I can see that dog stably controlling that person. I say, now, handler, go approach your dog. And I'll tell you that 2/3 of the dogs on the approach of the handler, once they're aware that handler's approaching, will start to swivel around and try and interpose the decoy between them and their handler. Why? Because they believe their handler's approach means he's going to make the fun stop. He's going to make this game end. They haven't been taught release as a game reset and an opportunity for more game. It means, no, the fun's going to stop, and that the handler is the discriminative stimulus that says that's going to happen. So I would, first off, I say, fix that, heal that rift. And then I tell people, by the way, you and your pet dogs do the same thing. And then I would say to the dog training community, we need to heal our rifts. We need to heal our rifts. I have been on both, you know, my pendulum in my career has swung from a devotee of force-based methods to a strong advocate of positive reinforcement-based methods to someone who now sees that actually it's not just about being in the middle. It's about trying your best to teach the dog in a way that the animal gets to choose what works for them. And then taking each individual animal's proclivities into account in the circumstances where you control the contingencies, the antecedents, and the consequences of a behavior, and setting them up for success, and understanding that sometimes there may be a place for emergency brakes. There may be a place for, it may be actually in keeping with the Hippocratic Oath. If you consider yourselves as a healer of dog relationship problems with dogs and that, the Hippocratic Oath doesn't say first cause no pain. It says first do no harm. So maybe even when you're applying a negative punishment, taking away an opportunity, that causes stress and discomfort. So I'm a believer in reducing the amount of intrusive interventions you have to do. But there may come a time that it's appropriate, and I don't want to judge somebody when they do it. I want to make sure that I'm understanding why they're doing it, and making sure that if we go forward working with that person and that dog, that they try and train in such a way that they reduce the need for that. I don't believe in perfection. I believe that it's worth pursuing all the time. My wife's dog's name is Kaizen, which the loose translation is continual pursuit of perfection, the way of perfection, pursuing the way of perfection. And I like that. You know, she's had him for a few years now, and he has been a dog that has done that for us. He came to us with baggage. He's still got some of it, but it's not as heavily laden as it once was. So if people can take that same kind of approach with each other, of giving themselves the chance to continually improve and seeing, meeting each other and with curiosity and appreciation of the look, this is where that person is, and not judging, but offering what assistance you can and being open. I'll be honest, if somebody gets better results than I'm getting, then I got to be curious about why I'm not doing what they're doing. And if it's a method that seems like I would never do that, but the results are speaking better. And I'm not just talking about strictly performance-based metrics, but if I see the relationship between that dog and that person, or that animal and that person, is intact and solid and they're having a great time, that's a result too. And if I see somebody having a better result with their animal than I'm having with my own, I better be curious, not envious, but curious. How do I get there?
Yeah, beautiful. And thank you once again, Steve, for sharing all of that. I know it's going to be really beneficial for everyone listening. We had 70, 80 minutes in this podcast to unpack 43 years of, or more, if we go back to Steve's childhood time in New York, walking dogs for a living. Air quotes. Hopefully we've done that justice. Hopefully you and the podcast audience appreciate the things we've decided to talk about today. And I know of those 43 years, we can definitely learn a lot. And I'm sure this conversation could go on nonstop for a couple of days, and we wouldn't stop pulling value from Steve and his experience. Before we do officially wrap up, Steve, can you just help everyone out that's out there that might want to learn more from you? See what you're up to. See where you're traveling to. See where they can meet you in person. Where can they go online to find that information out?
My website is proactivecanine.com. That's proactive, letter K, number 9, as one word, .com. I'll be down in Australia in November in Perth with 3B Events, doing a four-day series on tracking and scent work, and working with distance duration distraction, dog-centric, but anybody training anything is welcome to come. As always, I'm going to be kind of just focusing on my day-to-day stuff, training police dogs for my own law enforcement agency. For me, the side business, Proactive Canine, is what I will retire to, but it's my way of kind of bridging the two worlds, my police canine world and my civilian friends. So anybody who cares to get a hold of me can get a hold of me there. I'm also on Facebook. I'll talk with anybody about this stuff anytime. I look forward to talking with you again, Ryan, because this has been a real joy. That phone conversation we had on Sunday really sparked some curiosity in me about it. And you know, I always love your product. Your podcasts are interesting, and I'm honored beyond my ability to express at this opportunity to spend the time with you today.
Oh, thank you so much. That's humbling to hear coming from you. If you are in Australia, especially on that West Coast, and you can get to Perth for Steve's up-and-coming trip out there, then make sure you do. And shout out to the people at 3B Events who are doing some really neat stuff in that part of Australia. And once again, I just want to express, Steve, from myself, from everyone listening, thank you for today. Thank you for making time to come on the show today. Thank you for connecting with me last Sunday, for firing emails back and forth, for expressing your interest in creating potentially future content in the future. we really appreciate all your time and effort and attention given to this, Steve. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. With any luck, I'll see you next year in New Zealand.
Of course. And as soon as I find out that information, I'm going to be blocking that part off on my calendar. All of you listening out there as well, we really appreciate you tuning in today. If you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnish, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There is something there for absolutely everyone. We are looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. So long. Thanks for all the fish, and you'll hear from us again soon. Farewell.